Welcome to the Sports Medicine Podcast, brought to you by the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M University. At the Huffines Institute, we're always working to facilitate, apply, and bring you the most up-to-date coverage of the wide world that is sports medicine and human performance, all in language you can understand and share with your friends. And now, here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
I want to welcome everybody back to our weekly sports medicine podcast. Thank you all for joining us again. We have another week here, and we have another distinguished guest with us. We are very pleased to have Mr. Dave Kennedy with us. Dave is the head strength and conditioning coach for the Texas A&M football team. Before he came to A&M, he spent 12 years at The Ohio State. I have to make sure I get that right.
That's what they say on TV.
That's right. The Ohio State University, where he was strength and conditioning coach for football there for 12 years. And he moved on to Nebraska, where he held similar positions. And we're just so glad to have him here at A&M and with us today. How are you doing today, Dave?
Good. I went from Ohio State to Pittsburgh
for
2 years and then went back to Nebraska.
A man of great experience. No, yeah. That's great. So we're glad you're here today. We're going to talk to you about football strength and conditioning. What's the difference between strength and conditioning for football players as opposed to normal everyday people?
Everyday people as opposed to athletes? Any ground sport athlete, I pretty much train the same. I mean, I wouldn't train basketball players much different than football players. You know, the physical parameters of their game are determined by their size. Mm. But the things that make a great athlete are the same for most all ground sports. Now, there's a lot of physical contact. Big guys win in football, and it's a big guy, fast game. But the components that make a great player are the same. And so it's very specific to athletic performance, but not to, you know, general fitness.
Mm. We've got a lot of folks that listen to this. They're maybe a little bit younger. They have aspirations to be a college athlete down the road. Maybe they're football players now in high school or whatever. What would you tell them to focus on as they start to prepare to get better, stronger, faster?
You can never run too much. Mm. And the field is getting more and more specialized, but as it gets more specialized, it's drifted away from the fundamentals. And just like in any sport, you win with the fundamentals. If you're solid in the fundamentals of strength and conditioning, then it'll help you more than the little detail things. People work on the little detail things at the expense of the fundamentals.
Hmm. So does that mean that the general overall strength and conditioning program is similar between the different positions, or do you have really radical different programs for the different skill positions and like offensive linemen versus a defensive?
No, it's exactly the same for all positions. I stated in my opening statement that the components that make a great player are the same. Now, obviously, DBs aren't compared to linemen, but the best DBs have the same characteristics as the best linemen. You know, if you look at the NFL Combine, which is what everybody knows, everybody knows those stats and everybody knows those scores and the 40 and the shuttle runs and the benches and all that stuff. But every position does the exact same tests. Now, the DBs obviously aren't compared to the linebackers. Linebackers aren't compared to the offensive linemen. But within that group, they're compared. And they do the exact same thing. So the components that make a great player are the same, regardless of position.
And the test that they put the most weight on is like the 40-yard dash, right?
Yeah, that's the only one, really. You know, it's really become glamorized since it's got on the NFL Network, and everything's on TV, so everybody pays a lot of attention to everything. But the true correlation to how they're going to perform in the NFL, really the only test that holds true is the 40. Not the 10, not the shuttle, not the vertical, and certainly not the bench press.
Well, that's interesting. Why is that? Because they don't run – well, let's take an offensive lineman. He didn't run 40 yards very often.
Right, but it's showing natural athletic ability. I mean, you could really teach how to run a 10. A 10 will measure, horizontal explosiveness, and you would think that would be a really accurate measure for a sport where a burst is so important. But you could teach that and this technique on a 10. It's just held true that the best players have always run great 40s. And your fastest linemen are going to be your best athletes.
So if I'm naturally slow, can you teach speed?
Everybody's got a genetic potential. I mean, if you're naturally a 5'5 guy, you could get down, 5'1", 5'. you know, something like that. But if you're a 5-flat guy, then you're in the 4-7 guy range, you know, depending on what you've done, you know, up to that point when you start.
Even if I'm 50 years old?
50 years old, you're locked in. Now, you just get on the elliptical with everybody else at the health club and you'll be good.
So, yeah, there's a time point where it's useless.
Well, no, you know what? If you want to get in some of those senior races, we'll see what we can do. You know, I see those on Faces in the Crowd in Sports Illustrated, so if that's your goal, you know, everybody could get better.
How does the in-season – we're in the middle of football season, and how does the in-season – conditioning work differ from off season?
Oh, it's night and day different. Even during different periods of the off season, it's different. Hmm. You know, in the winter, for example, we concentrate on speed and power development. We aren't too concerned with conditioning because we don't play, you know, for 9 months. So we'll sacrifice some conditioning to be able to do more in speed and power and strength, you know. And people think you just do things all the time. Body could only recover from so much, and so we have to adjust what we do based on what's important at that time. And so we'll sacrifice some conditioning in the winter to be able to do more. And then, you know, in the summer, we sacrifice a little of this how fast we do our speed work because there's more of a conditioning component, getting them ready for the season. You know, and then during the season, which is where your question started, conditioning is taken care of on the field. We run certain days. You know, we have certain recovery runs that we do. But in the lifting is, and we never say maintenance. We're always trying to get better. Right. We keep the volume low and the load high, where most people think you keep the load low and the volume high. And so we will still go as heavy as we can for a certain number of reps without getting too specific.
You brought up recovery a couple of times. You're working with elite athletes. Do they recover faster than most normal folks?
You know, I have a whole range of, you know, there's 120-some football players. And within that 120, and we're at an elite university, okay, but within that 120 guys, there's a huge range of not only genetic ability, not only strength potential, power potential, but also in their ability to recover. Hmm. And their ability to hold their strength and hold their conditioning. So everybody is way different. And, you know, the thing I'm most interested in is recovery, because your body recovers the same whether it's a twisted ankle, whether it's a pounding that these guys take. You know, it's like a car wreck every game for sure, and then certain practices. I mean, you're getting in a car wreck, and you know, and then they have their practice where they're, you know, the workload, the physical workload, and so it taxes the recovery. And then we're in a hot climate, and so that's another factor. So recovery is huge, right, for in not only to be able to maintain your strength and power and your burst and all the things that, but, you know, but just to stay healthy, right, and not, we aren't even getting into viral or anything like that. So that's, I'm always looking for, you know, cutting edge recovery and monitoring our guys. But recovery generally happens when they're not around us. Mm. And so you preach and you preach and you pound and you pound, but you got to keep, you don't have a lot of control.
Right, right.
You know, when they're at home and they're, you know, we have cold tubs and we have a lot of recovery methods. We have different drinks. We have all that kind of stuff. But you know, if they aren't getting their sleep, then you're kind of beating your head against the wall. So that's something we continually stress, but so can't be overemphasized.
Is sleep a big component of the recovery?
To me, it's the number one form of recovery. I mean, you could do massages. You could do cold tubs. You could do any, you know, oxygen tents.
That'd be kind of tough.
Yeah, that'd really put you down. Yeah. I might be able to go to sleep, though. You know, without sleep, now that's a number one form of recovery.
Yeah.
Without question.
If you had your druthers, how many hours a night would you like to see them sleep?
You know, I'm not a sleep expert, okay? Right. I'm really not.
But you've got experience working with these kind of guys.
Yeah, and if, you know, the general rule is eight hours, but everything I've seen, more the better, okay, within reason. I don't know what the general number, the optimum number is. We just try to preach it.
What, you know, and you brought up an interesting point here, and I think that many people may not appreciate, and that is the modern athlete in a university setting, especially in a high-profile sport like football, they have demands on them all the time.
Yeah, and the internet and all the social networks, there's really, the NCAA mandates that you could only use 20 hours a week during the football season, and three of that is counted by the game. You know, so, and that's got to be documented and, I mean, double checked and triple checked.
So 20 hours of practice?
20 hours of everything.
Of everything.
Lifting, conditioning, practice, meetings.
Really?
Video review. You got 20 hours.
And you
got
to count the game in that.
The game counts as 3 hours.
Wow.
So it's all mandated time allotments. And within that, you can't use more than 4 hours a day. So, regardless of how you divide it up. And they have to have one day off. So there's a certain amount of recovery built in. You know, a general college student, you know, with their academic requirements, the academic study hall requirements and extra tutoring requirements, and then, you know, not to mention socially. So that all taxes one's ability to recover.
Right. Wow. Yeah, I just think that that's what so many people don't remember, is that these guys have a lot of demands on them besides just playing football.
Right.
They tend to think that that's all they do. Let's shift gears a little bit. How important are plyometrics in football? I mean, we hear about that a lot in the press, but.
Well, you know, plyometrics are kind of a buzzword, and you know, they got, you know, 72 Olympics was when the word came out, and it's huge. You know, everybody does certain kinds of jumps, but there's horizontal plyometrics, vertical plyometrics, and anything where there's any kind of stretch and reaction is a plyometric, truly. But it's a true power sport, and burst is the number one thing we're trying to develop. And when I say burst, I mean how sudden you could accelerate. So any quick, abrupt ability to change direction, transfer power, that's the number one thing that any player is evaluated on. It doesn't matter what level. If it's a high school player, the college coach is looking for the burst. If it's a college player, the NFL coach is looking for the burst. If it's an NFL player who's older, they're seeing if they continue to have their burst. And when a player is said to be washed up or done, it's because they don't have that same acceleration. It's very rarely top end. You know, they're looking for how sudden they could accelerate, because that is the key and to this game and how people are evaluated.
Well, it's interesting because you're really talking about two opposing forces here. To succeed in the game, to some extent, you have to be large nowadays.
Right.
But you also have to be able to move that mass fairly quickly. You have to change the direction fairly quickly.
Very quickly.
And get it going.
Right. And there's tremendous torques. There's tremendous collisions. Yeah, the amount of, you know, just straight physics. I mean, you don't have to be a wizard to figure that out.
Right.
But no, it's the big guys don't shrink and little guys get tired.
You know? Yeah. So eventually they all get injured to some extent, some way. Do they then not go to the weight room at all?
No.
Is there any kind of special rehab that they go through?
Yeah, it just depends on the individual. No, not everybody gets injured.
Okay.
I mean, you know, it's a wear and tear. Durability is probably as genetic as speed and strength and everything else.
Well, I mean,
and
you talked about that car wreck.
No, it's a car wreck, but you know, we have a... We have a player on our team whose father is a Hall of Famer from the NFL, played 20-some years, and his brother played 20-some years, and his father played 20-some years in the NFL, which is outrageously long,
yeah.
You know, for when the average career length is 3 years. So there's genetics involved in durability, just like there is in speed and height and hair color and everything else, in my opinion. Now, I don't have anything that's scientifically to base that on, but I've seen it.
So how important is your relationship with the team nutritionist, or with the RD? Do you work with them much?
Yeah, you know, they have a tough job. They deal with all sports. It's important to have a good relationship with everybody, you know, with everybody, with the training staff, with everybody else on the football staff, with the head coach. It's so important when time is limited. And there's such a stress on the body, and we're trying to do everything we can. Everybody's got to be on the exact same page,
right.
You know. And you talk about injuries. Well, I have to, you know, I meet with the trainers and doctors if there is injury, where there's a progression for guys who are, you know, injured on a particular day or a particular game, a week, and then there's long-term guys who have coming off surgery. So you know, everybody's got to be on the same page. So the relationship is. You know, key for nutrition, not only nutrition, but everybody involved in the football program.
So anybody out there that's listening that is going to be an athlete, they're going to have all these different influences, just not going to be the head coach. It's going to be the strength and conditioning coach. It's going to be the nutritionist. It's going to be, of course, the head coach and their position coach. But football really is more, when we say team sport, it really is more of a there's a team of specialists that actually work together to make all this happen.
Yeah, and you know, it's obviously very high profile sport.
Yeah.
And there's everybody knows there's a lot of money involved in football and college football, especially at this level. But I will go back to, you know, I know there's different levels of people maybe just middle school kids listening or high school kids. You know, just as in, I believe you stick with the fundamentals in strength and conditioning, you'll be solid. You know the fundamentals in nutrition, you'll be solid. I mean, people are looking for, you know, the easiest supplement, the quickest thing. If you're solid in the fundamentals of nutrition, you're solid in the fundamentals of recovery, you're solid in the fundamentals of strength and conditioning and speed work and burst work, you'll be way ahead of the game. Most people look for the bells and whistles, you know, rather than the truth. So that's my little shout out to people from different levels that, you know, it's very specific. It's very controlled in a high level university. And if you're lucky to get to that level, it's phenomenal.
Yeah.
But if you just want to be the best middle school player or the best high school player, pay attention to the fundamentals. And if you pay attention to the fundamentals, you'll be successful.
Yeah. It strikes me. It's not so hard. Sometimes, I mean, I shouldn't say it's not hard. It's hard to do, but the concepts are not hard. I mean, it's fairly simple, and people try to make it very complex
sometimes. Right. Everybody wants to make it rocket science. It's really not rocket science. You work hard on the fundamentals, you're good. If you can run and block and tackle, you'll be good.
You'll be okay.
You'll be okay. So learn the fundamentals. Make sure you're solid in the fundamentals in all aspects.
Yeah. Now let's talk about if someone wanted to have your job. You know, let's say they wanted to become a strength and conditioning coach. What kind of, let's say they're in high school right now, and they say, you know, I really want to do what Dave Kennedy does. So what is the progression? What's that job track look like for them?
From my experiences, if I was recommending, if I could make a blueprint for someone at that age, which is a great age, first of all, I'd have them participate in as many sports as possible. Mm. Secondly, I'd have them familiarize themselves with as many strength and conditioning philosophies as possible and do them themselves. I would have them compete as an Olympic lifter. I'd have them compete as a power lifter. I would have them be familiar with Eastern block training. I'd definitely have them run track. I'd have them, if they couldn't help with the track team or weren't talented enough to run track, to be a manager on the track team. Mm-hmm. And get that kind of feel in high school. Then I'd have a major in exercise science when they got to college. But I would and that is the foundation. Mm. But the key is experience.
Right.
The true experience. So I would, if my son wanted to do it and he was going to go to college, I'd say you start volunteering day one.
Right.
Because really I had 8 years experience by the time I was 28, and people get hired in this profession by who you know. There's all kinds of exercise physiologists and people that have the academic background but don't have the experience. Mm. Really, it's coaches that are doing the hiring of strength coaches.
Right.
So they aren't going to hire someone with no experience.
Right.
And coaches just call other coaches to see who's, hey, you got a good guy.
Right.
And so it's kind of like it's a who you know network, like anything.
Right.
So you have to get that experience to have a chance and really have to get that experience and get with a skeptical lie, so you can incorporate what you've learned, see what you like,
right,
and
right.
See what you don't like,
right.
and come up with your own philosophy.
Right. Well, you know, you've just hit two huge key points that I think are important and worth reiterating. That's experience. You got to have experience, especially in the weight room, and go volunteer. They're not going to get paid for that experience
right.
often,
right.
but go volunteer. And it's who you know, so meet people. Don't be shy.
Right. Right, and you know a thing that is greatly overlooked that you can have all the background, but you have to understand how to get people to do it, get players to do it, because you could have the most sophisticated, elaborate, well thought out program, and if you can't get them to do it, then it's just a worthless piece of paper, or computer program, or any internet cast or whatever. It's useless if they won't do it. So the components that make a great coach, regardless, none of it's rocket science. And whether you're head football coach, strength and conditioning coach, basketball coach, the great ones get the players to do it. And so that's what you have to pay attention to, you know, and know what you're doing and your experience and being able to justify what you're doing is probably the greatest motivator.
Right. So what are the keys to getting people to do what you want to ask them to do in the weight room?
First of all, they have to believe in it. I mean, kids work their tails. Everybody works their tails off. If you know, if it's going to make you better, they're going to do it.
Right.
If they know it's going to make it better, they're going to do it. Hmm. Okay, because everybody wants to be a better player.
And you don't have to show them charts or graphs or anything.
No, no, they know. They know. They know. You feel it. But they know if they're better, and they know if they feel better. And that's, you know, they'll put in the work if it's going to make them better. And secondly, you have to have enough background and enough confidence to have a conversation with someone to say why we're doing what we're doing.
Right.
The days where you say, you know, hey, do this, and they say, why? You say, because I'm the coach. You know, that you've lost the greatest motivation.
Right.
You know, justification of program is probably the greatest motivator. Mm. We do this because of this. Oh, that makes sense, and I will do it.
Right.
You know, so, you know, getting them to do that and understanding that you're dealing with people who want to improve on the field is the number one motivator of all. And I don't care if you're a 14-year NFL vet who's trying to hang on. They need to do certain things to hang on. If you could help them hang on, they'll do it. If you could help a walk-on become a special teamer or become a guy who plays, if you could help a scholarship guy get to his ultimate goals, that's everybody will work for that.
Hmm. So experience, which leads to expertise, networking, and figuring out how to get people motivate people to do what you're
right.
asking them to
right.
do. Those sound like three great keys.
Right.
As we wrap up here today, any take-home messages you'd like to send out there to the folks that are listening about weight training in general or strength and conditioning?
Okay, I spoke, you know, this whole conversation has been about athletes, and I say, you know, it's rooted in the fundamentals. Now, there's some very specific things that we do that I couldn't get into in this kind of conversation. But just with the general public, I think the general public and everybody wants to look good.
Mm.
Okay, if they're listening and they're general public, they're trying to pick up a key to how to look good.
Yeah.
And once again, it's my philosophy that people, there's so many little side things out there that if they would be rooted in the fundamentals,
right.
that's the big, you work the big muscle groups, you have muscle mass, you burn more calories. That's the key.
Right.
I mean, there's so many little side. It doesn't matter what kind of training thing it is this week, it's little.
Right, right.
The big stuff is still the difference maker stuff.
Right.
Okay, and am I telling guys to lunge 315 or do lunges and cleans and things? No, I'm not saying that, but do the big stuff. You win with the big stuff. It doesn't matter what sport, it doesn't matter. Strength and conditioning, doesn't matter. Basketball, it doesn't matter. Football, it doesn't matter. Personal fitness. You do the big stuff, and that's way more important than the little.
Yeah, and I think, and again, it comes back to what we were talking about a while ago. People try to make it too complex at times. And that even goes just for the recreational athlete. They try to make, you know, they want the protein powder that's going to get them there quicker than anything else, and it's just get in the gym and lift.
Yeah, too complex or too easy. They want the easy. Hey, if I shake this little thing, I'll be good. Okay, that guy did that. So, it's generally, it always circles around hard work.
Yeah.
It's really a fun thing to be a part of, though.
Yeah. And yes, we all want to look good. And matter of fact, the three of us in this room look, you know, pretty good. Actually, it's a good thing this isn't video.
Yeah,
though, right.
Well, for some people, I don't know if I'm jumping in that one.
Well, Dave, we sure appreciate you coming by today. We thank everyone that's been listening today for the podcast. We invite you back next week. Again, the best thing to do is go out to iTunes and just type in Huffines Institute, and you will find us. And just go ahead and subscribe. And that way, every week, automatically, this podcast will be downloaded into your MP3 player. And you can find out what fun we're having here in the world of sports medicine. I want to thank our producer, Justin Dobson, for all he's done to keep us on track here. As we turn it over to John Miles for the closing credits, we just remind you to be active and be well. Thanks.
The Sports Medicine Podcast is produced by Justin Dobson and licensed by the Huffines Institute at Texas A&M under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zeltner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzeltner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by John Miles Productions at johnmilesproductions.com. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, We hope you have an active and healthy week.